climate and weather on our minds right now with our weather guys, John Martin and Steve Ackerman. Steve's director of the Cooperative Institute for Meteorological Satellite Studies at UW-Madison, professor of atmospheric sciences. John Martin is professor and chair of the Department of Atmospheric and Oceanic Sciences at UW-Madison. And they come by the last Monday of every month to talk about climate and weather. You may have a question. We had some severe weather times coming up. Hurricane season's coming up here. We can talk a little bit about that. We can talk maybe about our winters and certainly answer your questions when you call at 1-800-642-1234. You can email us at talk@wpr.org or post on my Facebook page. If you got a good weather photo, we'd love to see that. Go to the Larry Mueller Show Facebook page, post your photo there, and we'll get the guys to comment on it. Steve, good to see you again.
It's great to be here. Yeah. This time marker of every month.
That's right.
Marks my life.
John Martin, you're looking healthy and hale and hearty. And
yeah, same to you, Larry. It's good to see you.
Well, let's jump right into it. Fall predictions? Are you guys got any fall predictions?
I'm going to predict above average to go along with National Weather Service for the next month. Precipitation, it could. The El Nino is developing, although it's not going to be a strong one, it doesn't look like, which is good because that usually means lower than normal precipitation up north, less snowfall. So,
all right.
And that would lead to a warmer Wisconsin as well.
Yeah, I'd say I agree with Steve. I see no particular reason to expect it'll get suddenly very cold.
So all right. Well, I
keep on being warm.
In order to check on you guys, I have not yet looked in the Farmer's Almanac to see if you're right.
Well, John's favorite reading.
While you're at it, can you get me a coupon for motor oil?
Oh, yeah. Well, we'll have to talk about the Farmer's Almanac. The 2013 one is out. It's always fun to read through it. Anyway,
it is a great book. We were talking about it out there. It's a great book.
But it's like Reader's Digest. You want to read it, but not too seriously.
Exactly.
Maybe as you're waiting for the dentist.
Yeah, or the Red Sox yearbook. You know, you read it for interest, but it's not going to tell you who's going to win the World Series.
Well, here we've got on our Facebook page at the Larry Mueller Show, we have a really cool cloud photo. Mammatus clouds?
Yeah, those are Mammatus clouds.
Mammatus, is that how it's?
Yeah, that's how I've always heard it. Yeah.
Okay, Mammatus clouds. And they're sort of, like bulbs or?
Yeah, they're like udders hanging down, usually on the anvil side of thunderstorm is where you mostly see them.
And as far as I understand, no one really completely understands how you get that cloud formation.
Yeah.
Because one of the things that's interesting about them is one of the theories is it's air that's moving downward as it's negatively buoyant. But if that's the case, how does it remain cloudy in that air? It's kind of a tricky business to try to figure that out. Yeah. Why should it take on those shapes?
Well, this is really cool because it's sort of there's a gold cast or kind of a yellow cast of the whole thing.
It's gorgeous.
So that's usually going to be, I'm going to guess, a sunset type picture.
Yeah.
I mean, you usually get the yellow cloud, sunset or sunrise, but thunderstorms are usually in the afternoon. So.
And Mammatus, you're saying?
Okay.
Well, thank you very much, Tad, for sending that photo. And anybody else have some interesting weather photos? We'd love to see them at the Larry Mueller Show Facebook page. Mm-hmm. Let's go to Peter in Minocqua. Hi, Peter.
How you doing?
Good.
Well, my question is, I've had several people talk to me about the fact that we're going to have a very bad winter, which for me is good, with lots of snow and cold because the acorns are much more plentiful and larger. And I'm just wondering if there's anything to that.
I've never heard that one.
No,
before.
And actually,
I've heard that one.
Yeah, I've heard it. And actually, in my memory, last year we had a ton of acorns, at least on our property, on our driveway. It was just littered. I haven't had that many this year.
Well, yeah.
And what was last year? Last year wasn't.
No,
it was warmer.
Yeah, it was really warm and boring winter.
I think that acorns, and I've heard this before. I mean, Peter's not the first guy that I've heard this from, but I think that acorns are more a function of the weather previous. A dry, droughty conditions, which we've had now for a couple years, tends to force plants like trees to produce more potential seed fruit.
Oh, okay.
Interesting.
So they're gonna when you're stressed, when the plant's stressed.
Yeah.
I know the orchardists, the guys say, you know, if your peach tree isn't producing peaches, take a baseball bat to it.
Wow. Stress it out.
Whack it hard. Yeah, stress it. Wow. And you'll actually get, you'll force it into producing.
Oh. Yeah, I'll teach you, you peach tree.
So I don't know whether or not dry conditions or stress-reducing conditions back then would lead to something different in the winter.
Yeah. That's very interesting. I doubt it. I think one of the things that it strikes me is this kind of a story that you start to see more squirrels running around because the nuts are a little bit bigger, and they kind of know that because it's a big part of their food. And then I remember thinking as a kid and hearing this from adults, oh, yeah, if you see a lot of squirrels, they kind of know something's coming. You know? And so that's maybe
so
how you get to
out for the winter.
That's
yeah.
how you get to the point where it turns into a predictor. I don't know if it's true, though.
But, yeah, with the El Nino coming on, we're looking at probably a slightly warmer than normal.
Yeah, right.
Not a colder one.
And so, Peter, that's not good news for you.
Yeah. Or John.
Oh, well, our lake is low. Our lake is low, so I guess it was wishful thinking.
Oh, yeah. There are a lot of low lakes.
Yeah, our lake seems really low, too.
Yeah.
I just mentioned that.
They're all low. Peter, thank you. I'm sorry we couldn't give you
better news. But
better news. Yeah.
Doesn't look good, though.
Take care. Thanks a lot for calling. You can join in, too, at 1-800-642-1234 or email us at talk@wpr.org. Hurricane season is
winding down. About another.
Yeah, well, we're just maybe a week or 10
days
past its peak. Yeah, we're a little bit past its peak, but not really probably within the margin of error. We're right about there.
Yeah.
How's it shaped up? I mean, we had a bad one, one bad one.
Yeah, what did we get to? Nadine is the one they're flying around right now, and that's way up in the North Atlantic. It's in an odd position. We've had several in a row have gone in fairly odd positions. So we're all the way up to N, which is 13 named storms, 14 named storms.
And the prediction was 12 to 17,
yeah,
I think is what Noah was predicting. Yeah, what they updated.
So they were right on the money.
So far. And I think I'd say we're probably going to exceed it by a good amount because, you know, you're going to have most of September and, well, the rest of September and a good part of October is still a reasonable threat for tropical storms.
Okay, so worse than they may have predicted.
I think so, yeah.
Why is there a season? Why are there seasons for hurricanes and tornadoes, for example?
Oh, that's a good question. For the hurricanes, it has a lot to do with whether or not one of the things that kills hurricanes is vertical shear, which is winds that are at different speeds and directions at different heights in the atmosphere. And one of the ways that you can get vertical shear intruding into the tropics is to cool off the high latitudes. So as the wintertime encroaches, you have a hard time fighting the vertical shear. And as you're coming out of the winter into the early spring, the shear is hanging around at low latitudes again because the wintertime is still hanging out there in some way, shape, or form. So it's not really till the dog days of summer that you finally have kicked all of that stuff far to the north and you can develop tropical storms. Tornadoes follow the jet stream, so it's kind of related, although not the exact same idea, but it's kind of related. So there's a seasonality, again, tied to the jet that drives those things.
Hmm. Well, John in Port Wing, thank you for calling. Hi.
Hi, Larry. Hi, guys.
Hello.
How you doing?
Pretty good. Mm. Beautiful day up here on shores of Lake Superior.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Is there another kind? It's great, great up there.
Even when they get 2 feet of snow, it's still great.
Oh, yeah.
We're so close that we're in that shadow where we don't get much snow. We're right near the shore.
Yeah. Right.
My question is, the local weathercasters up here, television guys, keep talking about, here comes the weather, it's coming in, a lot of moist air, and then they say it runs into this large dome or cell of dry air over Lake Superior.
Hmm.
Why is there an accumulation of dry air over such a big lake?
I think it might not be 100% accurate. One thing that's for sure at the time of year where you have to worry about thunderstorm activity is that the lake is a very cold spot. The lake water is a lot colder than the air. And I think that helps to, you know, if you get a little bit above the first 10 or so meters of air above the lake, it's more than likely that has less water vapor in it than the air over land. Because it's so much colder, and if there's no cloud in it, then there's probably less water vapor in it. So it might be a mixture of those two kinds of things that they're talking about, a pretty deep layer of air that's probably drier than air over the land in the summertime. But it's not really that it's dry right over the lake itself.
There you go. Thanks, John. Tom in Fond du Lac. Hi.
Hi. I used to live in a heavily wooded area, And we'd be sitting out on the porch in the evening, 8 or 9 at night perhaps, and the air would be absolutely still, and all of a sudden a little whirlwind would come through. And I'm just wondering, what would cause that, and is there a name for that?
It's like a little dust devil?
Mm. Yes.
That would be, you know, like a foot across or something.
Huh.
What would it be?
What, you know,
small,
like a foot across.
Oh, yeah, or maybe just a little larger.
Mm. Yeah.
Enough so it would be very noticeable.
And this was over a lake, did you say?
No, this was actually, we had
a wooded area.
In a wooded area.
But it was on the shore of a lake.
Yeah, that's...
Okay, so you get a gradient of temperature, because a lot of times those whirlwinds are caused by gradients of temperature at the surface.
Yeah, and you get a little bit of gustiness that arises, and then there's so many obstacles, because you got the woods nearby, that it's easy to have the winds kind of swirl around those obstacles. On a day that otherwise isn't even windy, it can happen. Yeah. Pretty interesting.
Yeah, that is interesting.
And we were talking earlier, too, about the impact of lakes on a lot of different weather events.
Yeah.
So the airport temperature just this morning zipped up to like 47 degrees, and everybody else was, what, in the 30s?
Mid-30s or so.
And part of that was the winds coming off the Lake Mendota and pushing warmer air over the
just
lakes.
Amazing. Local effects like
local
that.
Local effects, yeah.
Well, the weather service always, the temperature is always different from my place, that's for sure.
it's
unusual that the airport's warmer than surrounding locations. It's
usually colder,
John Martin and Steve Ackerman, our guests, are weather guys, and they will be with us right up until 12:30. So you stay with us here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Talking climate and weather today with our weather guys, Steve Ackerman and John Martin. They always do a wonderful job about this fascinating topic of weather. You may have some questions, some weather-related questions for them, and please join in. I'd love to hear from you at 1-800-642-1234. Email us at talk@wpr.org. And let's see if we've got a... And also go to my Facebook page. Love to see any photos that you might have. And as a matter of fact, I'm looking at our Facebook page right now and seeing a rainstorm that was preceded by an unusual cloud formation, undulatus apparatus.
Wow. Yeah, that's a gorgeous photo, and a lot of times you see that wavy bottom under the cloud. It looks like it's raining beyond, too,
right on
the horizon.
Right. Yeah,
that undulation is always really interesting when you get in those altocumulus-type clouds or alto-type clouds.
You used to see that a lot in Seattle, I remember. It was much more common there than it seems to be here. It was might have some orographic connection, too, before it starts to rain, but it's beautiful. Yeah, it's very striking.
Do you know what does it? Is it the stability that makes those, like pockets, upside-down pockets?
Yeah, maybe it is. I never really have paid attention enough to see if it's kind of before the warm frontal precipitation begins. But if it were consistently there, then stability's a big deal.
I always just look at it and go, wow, that's cool. Get my camera, take a picture, and then forget about it.
Right, exactly. You don't go back and look at a map and try to place it where it belongs. It's probably warm frontal because
it's got to be some, instability.
I think you're right.
Madeline emailed us and wondered why southern Spain on the Mediterranean has such a different climate from Wisconsin, even though we're at the same latitude.
It has to do with the Mediterranean Sea. Water modulates extremes, so they don't get nearly as cold in the winter, and they don't get nearly as hot generally.
In the central part of Spain,
Madrid gets really hot. Yeah.
But not the whole southern part of the country. Yeah.
So it's that Mediterranean influence.
And Tom in Wausau wonders if the heat that concrete is in concrete at an airport, if that absorbs... obviously the concrete absorbs a lot of heat. Yeah. Does that affect the readings on the weather readings we get from the airport? Wouldn't that increase the temperature?
They do have really strict rules about where the temperature has to be sited, that is actually placed, to make sure that these kinds of things don't affect it. And you'd be surprised how great an insulator the air is. If you're only 3 meters above the ground, even if you're over a cement slab, it's really not going to do much to your temperature if you're that high, 10 feet or so above the ground. And they place them in such a way to try and mitigate against any such effects. We used to swear, though, at SeaTac, when I was forecasting as a graduate student there, we'd forecast in a contest in the department. We would swear that if there was a 747 turning around and taking off to go to Tokyo or something, you know, you'd get this big blast of heat. The thermometer, sometimes it'd be days with temperature go up 8 degrees in an hour, and you'd screw up your forecast there, and you'd blame Pan Am or somebody. But I think those things are apocryphal. They're not really true.
They're finger pointing, not necessarily.
Right, right.
Julie emailed and wondered, doesn't it mean if you have a warmer winter, as you were talking about, Steve, that we'll get more snow? Does a warmer winter mean more snow?
There's a pretty wide range of temperature in which you can get a lot of snow. So, you know, if you get a bitterly cold winter where it's, you know, the average temperature is below zero here, which is never going to happen. But if it were to happen, I bet you that would come with a lot less snow.
Yeah.
But the range in which you can get a good amount of snow and still be warmer or colder is pretty wide.
Gloria in Milwaukee, in Madison, excuse me. Thank you for calling. Hi.
Oh, thank you for taking my call. I really appreciate it because I have oodles of questions, but I'll hone it down to just one here.
Okay.
You know, my big concern is that we had a really hot summer, and comparing to the summer before and the summer before, and now we're taking a look at, you know, the crops, they couldn't stand the 100-degree weather in the Midwest here in Wisconsin. Never had that before, you know, day after day. And we had soybeans. We had corn that burnt up. We had some trees. We had wells that dried. And we even had right there in Washington, D.C., they never had such buckling of the rails. Now, if we have that a temperature increase, my understanding, Greenland is actually being melted too right now. You know, I don't know how many years, but now it's only 10 years before it maybe be all melted. So, and then we have, of course, the oil companies that want to have covered this up for years and years and years with millions of dollars about this global warming. What are we going to do then next year? Is it going to increase that amount next year compared to, I know I'm throwing a lot of things at you guys, and I apologize for that, but I said I had a lot of thoughts.
No.
What is going to happen the next summer, you know, and is there anything that we can do? We ourselves bought an electric car, so we have zero emissions. What are some of the things that people can do that are so concerned about this? What's going to happen next year?
Yeah, I mean, that's a great question. And predicting specifically what's going to happen next year is really hard, because even though we saw real warming this past summer, the variability, the variations from year to year are really large. And so we really have to average over 4 or 5 years, and then you really see that trend of increasing temperatures in the summertime and in the wintertime in particular. But I think you raise up a good question, and that is that as we look out, you know, 50 years or so, where we're seeing that trend continue and no way of ameliorating that trend, brings up this issue of adaptation, you know. Mm-hmm. So what are we going to do in order to adapt to this change? Because we're certainly not trying to mitigate the change in any way.
Yeah, and I think this is all really interesting stuff. You know, another way to rephrase the questions that you had was, what is it going to take to kind of erode some of the skepticism that people have about whether or not we really do have a problem on our hands that we could maybe take some action against? I think no one's predicting a colder than normal summer. That's not happening.
No.
People don't do that. They're not predicting the globe's going to cool. So there's really a one-sided set of predictions here, and the one-sided nature of this is based upon evidence and projections based on that evidence. So, you know, when you get a summer like this, you don't want to overstate its importance in terms of what it proves and disproves. But on the other hand, you know, I think that we're likely to have a higher frequency of such summers from now on. We won't wait 25 years to see another one like this, like we did between 1988 and now. That's my guess. And I say that with firm confidence that we're not going to have to wait 25 years to see this kind of a summer again, as unusual as it was.
And Kathleen, earlier this morning, Kathleen had Walt Meyer on, who's her show. He's a research scientist with the National Snow and Ice Data Center at the University of Colorado in Boulder. And the amount of ice in the Arctic Ocean has shrunk. It's an all-time low.
And this is the peak of the melt season. So this is as small as the area gets, and about the same time as the peak of the hurricane season, early September. And so it's really devastatingly low this year. Bad news.
Thanks for calling, Gloria. Appreciate your call.
And glad you bought an electric car and are actually thinking about what you can do to adapt to this, because I think that's what it's going to take.
We gotta.
If we keep ignoring it, then it's only going to be harder to adapt. And I'm sure the seed companies that are thinking about how to, you know, get strains of corn that can deal with this type of variability are probably the ones that are going to do the best in the next 50
years.
That's
right. I mean, in fact, that's a really good point. Not only seed companies, but insurance companies. If you want to see where the market's going on this issue, follow the insurance companies and the producers of grain. They know what's up. They hedge their bets against this, and they're paying close attention to this issue. So there might be some in the community who say it's unreal, it's a fraud, it's made up, you know, to fund people's grants. That's not what the insurance people think.
Right.
No. There you go, Gloria. Thank you again for calling. I want to turn to Jeff in Madison next. Jeff, hi.
Hi, gentlemen. I've been, of course, listening. I didn't hear your first segment. You usually have one before noon, and I get out for lunch about now. I know people get a lot more reactive when you have the phenomenon of the weather. I can remember the summer of 2009 when we had temperatures that never got over 90 except one day, and I didn't hear a lot of global warming issues. But, you know, and I'm not here to talk about that, really. I'm here to talk about is how, considering that the El Nino was to be kicking in again, how that would affect the long-range forecast of the National Weather Service. Is that taken into consideration for the upper Midwest when they predict the type of winter we're looking at now with the warmer temperatures? Is that a factor?
Yeah, it's one of the factors that goes in as a predictor by the Climate Prediction Center. It's not really the Weather Service that has the obligation to make long-term forecasts. They're more 0 to 10 day forecast range. But that's exactly correct. That's one of the factors, not the only one, but it's one of them, and it may be one of the leading ones, actually.
Mm-hmm. All right. So this one, have they gauged how strong this one's going to be?
Yeah, they've been looking at it, this El Nino, as being between a weak one and a moderate one. Which means that the correlation and the statistics, of course,
not so good.
Yeah, get weaker.
All right. Well, I'll be buying extra coats. I'll be expecting a bitterly cold winter now that the
warmer.
No,
go the other way.
I know. Don't say he's got a no hitter going. I know what you're talking about. I'm with you.
Oh, boy. Thanks, Jeff. Oh, man. Nick in Appleton. Hi.
Hi, Larry. Great show.
Thanks.
My question is kind of a combination of a weather question and a wildlife or fishing question. Last week, my dad and I were up in O'Connell County muskie fishing right during that giant cold front that was pushing through the state. And the bite was horrible, and fishermen always say that cold fronts are horrible for fishing, and my experience matches that as well. And I'm just curious if your guests know any detail about that or any research that's been done about how those big systems, those big fronts, shut down the bite or shut down other wildlife. And that's my question.
Oh, that's a good question.
Yeah, I'm not sure I know. I think I've heard, though, that when the water gets disturbed and the water gets colder, and they'd both be happening at the same time, that the fish go down to depth, and then it's just a lot less exciting for them to be thinking about food, and it's even worse for the fishermen. I think a gradual cool down is better than the rapid cool down of a cold front. That's what I've heard from some of my friends who fish. I don't myself, but I've heard those things. And so I don't know how true that is.
And to me, the thing that comes to my mind is the old saying that, you know, winds from the west, fish bite best, which would almost be behind a sort of a cold front. That's
but
northwest.
The only problem with that is that westerly winds can also be fair weather winds. Warm and
right.
So if it's you'd almost think that the cold front would get a special mention in that fishing lore.
Yeah, and
it doesn't. So
winds from the east, fish bite least.
Yeah,
so that would be a warm front.
Then you got a storm.
A storm.
In terms of like muskies, if you have a rainstorm now ahead of a rainstorm or even during a storm, I've had great action on
is that
muskie.
Right? Do they come?
We
to
boated out of our boat 13 muskies in a 45-minute rainstorm, or just ahead of it. In one storm.
See, now maybe they react to the pressure.
The sun came out and they quit just like that.
It's very interesting. I would have thought they maybe react to pressure, but I don't know how they work.
But I don't think pressure would exert enough, you know, to influence the water.
Yeah, it wouldn't seem
so
like
the air pressure.
Wouldn't seem like it.
But I'm always out on the water. If I can get out on the water ahead of a storm, no, I'm out there if I'm going to musky fish.
How do you like that?
If I can jump in quick, I'll confirm that the action was really good right before, like, Wednesday afternoon.
Yeah.
It was good. The muskies were hot. They were ready to go. But then Wednesday night and, you know, Thursday, Friday, we got the on-and-off rain and really strong winds, temperature dropped big time, and then it turned off. So, but anyways, I appreciate your answers.
Yeah, thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate your call. Sometimes the wind is good sometimes for musky fishing.
Yeah.
I think a bigger fish, for some reason, it may be that because of the wave action, they may have it stirs up bait and fish, but it also hides the boat.
Yeah, yeah.
And the fisherman standing up in the boat casting a bit. But Robert in South Milwaukee. Hi, thank you for calling.
Thank you. How do you guys see coronal mass ejection affecting our weather over the next year, and how does that affect global warming?
All right. Steve Ackerman, what is coronal mass ejection first?
These are big ejections of energy that come from the sun. And usually associated with active suns when we have a lot of sunspots like we currently do now. And when they interact with the Earth, and particularly in the upper atmosphere, we have what we call space weather. So it generates weather up high, and in particular, aurora borealises are usually what you see really nice things.
Yeah.
But they can also really affect communications and knock out communications and even transmission lines. I know there was a couple of years ago where a big flare, solar flare, knocked out transmission lines and thus power and energy. And I think that's more of a concern than long-term energy. Long-term impacts on weather and climate, particularly in the troposphere where we live.
Yeah, I think that's true.
Yeah.
All right.
Thanks, Robert. Appreciate it. Excuse me. And Judy, it's your turn. Hi, Judy.
Hi. We've been vacationing in Escanaba for 16 years, and then my husband and I recently retired and bought a property on the Bay of Green Bay. The people that are neighbors that have lived there their whole lives, they said that this water table is the lowest that they've ever seen. Just wondering how the Great Lakes are affected by all the global warming, and I know inland lakes are also affected. Just if the lake level will ever come back.
Yeah, the lake level of Superior and Michigan in particular have been below normal for a long time. I think almost since we've been doing this show.
Yeah, I think that's
since
right.
Since 98,
yeah.
And it's never come up.
That's right.
And back in those early days, I tended to blame it on an El Nino because we got very little snowfall to replenish it because the watershed of the Great Lakes is really small
in
comparison to this
small.
Size.
Yeah, it's very, very small.
So the issue with global warming and level lake level is a couple of things. One is evaporation. So if you don't get ice on the lakes, on Green Bay in particular, in the small lakes, then in the wintertime you're going to have more evaporation when those cold air outbreaks come by, for one thing. It's complicated because we also have the Army Corps of Engineers adjusting lake levels as well, that move water around between the lakes in order to keep shipping going.
Yeah, we've heard that too.
And if you don't import water from another spot, you know, far remote from the Great Lakes, you really have trouble because, you know, we might be, this summer in particular, we may have been evaporating water off of all the big lakes and then sending it to southern Canada outside the watershed where it might have finally turned into a thunderstorm and all that water came down there and doesn't get back to the Great Lakes. So every time that happens, you lose some.
Yeah. We actually got a lot more rain up here than down in where we used to live by the valley, Fox Valley. They were, you know, a lot drier. So
yeah.
We did notice more rain up here.
Yeah.
Yeah. Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Appreciate it. And we had Michael sent us a photo of a water spout.
Is
that on Lake Michigan?
Is that one of the Lake Michigan water spots?
Yes.
Oh, that was dramatic. Yeah. Wow.
I lost it there.
Seems like Michael was wiser than the other person who took these things. He was far enough away that he could see it from a distance and enjoy it.
So did somebody get a little too close?
I don't think anybody had any trouble, but the one movie I saw was the guy was right off the front of his boat. He must have been petrified.
Yeah, yeah.
Man. Here's another photo from Conrad and Madison. What type of clouds are these?
They look like Mammatus again.
Yeah, they do.
Yeah,
They got the pouch. Anytime you get those pouches hanging down from the bottom of clouds, that's
Mammatus.
Usually Mammatus.
Wow. Jan emailed us, is there any chance we'll ever have a good old-fashioned winter again? The kind we used to get when I was a kid.
You mean like 2007, 2008 when we had 103 inches of snow? Is that what you mean? That was just a couple of years ago.
A little more than a couple now.
Yeah, right.
It's like 5 years ago. But...
Well, they happen. I mean, that just proves that they happen. And we had a great December of 2000, if you remember that we had a tremendous amount of snow in the month of December 2000. So... You know, I'm the eternal optimist, but I have reason to be optimistic for a good old-fashioned winter. We get them occasionally.
We do,
And I'd say that's more the rule than the exception.
And that's why we live here.
Yeah,
right? Those winters.
All that I do.
All it's that and Packers and brats and cheese.
So I think so. I think there's a maybe not for this winter, but there's, you know, if you can look forward three or four winters in a row, one of those three or four is going to be pretty good.
Yeah. Be a pretty,
let's hope.
Yeah, I enjoy snow. I like to have the, otherwise there's no snowshoeing, there's no cross-country skiing.
So
it's just frozen brown ground.
Frankly, I haven't done any snowshoeing for the last few years because there wasn't very much snow. Yeah. I did a little cross-country, but... Yeah.
Well, the other thing to remember, if you're thinking about Christmas, not Christmases only, but winters from when you were a kid, you got to try and imagine yourself about 3 feet high again.
Yeah.
And then a foot of snow comes up to your waist,
It is really deep.
That puts the edge on it a little bit.
Well, Betty in Wisconsin Rapids is going to take us to a warmer place, I think. Hi, Betty.
Hi. And love weather. And I know you're short of time. This is a trivia that I read years ago, that we have to have hurricanes to disrupt the equator and the hot air in order to get good weather around the world or to change the weather around the world. If we don't have hurricanes, why? What happens?
Well, hurricanes do an enormously important job. It might be somewhat related to this story. They do an enormously important job of ventilating the tropical ocean. Because if that doesn't happen, we could have all kinds of weird things happening at high latitudes during the cold season, and that's probably not a very good thing. So the hurricanes do a great job of taking heat out of the ocean in the tropics during the late summer and early fall, and there isn't quite as much of it left available to start screwing around with the circulation for the cold season in either hemisphere. Mm-hmm. So they do an important ventilation job.
Oh, wonderful. That's another dinner party trivia thing.
Watch how quickly people run away from you.
Right. All right. Thanks, guys.
Thanks, Betty. And the book Air that we were talking about earlier, it's interesting. And he talks in that book about certain minerals that are actually picked up in the air from Africa that wind up essential to
the Amazon forest, for one.
Yeah, yeah. To the Amazon forest, for one. It's really fascinating.
Yeah, it's amazing. Yeah. It's just amazing the kind of stuff. And then there's dust in the Greenland ice sheet that they can tell what the climate was like from, hundreds of thousands of years ago based on where that dust came from. They can make extrapolations about what kind of storminess there must have been. It's just amazing.
Yeah.
So what are we looking at the next month or so then? You're saying probably for winter?
Above average temperatures. I mean, we see this warming trend going for so long that, in fact, September was cooler than normal for the first time in many, many months.
But we're not done yet.
We
might be able to creep over zero.
Right. We're not going to get 90, but...
No, that's done. Put a fork in that. But we're thinking, how many months in a row can we be above normal at Truax? And I don't know how many we actually have right now, but I think it's bordering on almost 12 straight months of above normal
temperatures.
Have to
look that up for next month. It'll be interesting to have that the last Monday of October.
Yeah, it will be. That'll be a really good topic of conversation.
And we're doing science this week on Saturday. We're doing a
quick plug. Give it a plug.
At WIDS on Saturday at 4:30.
For Discovery in Madison, UW campus.
Yep, we'll be there with Nova and doing a science cafe.
It should be pretty fun.
Yeah, lots so bring your questions. If you have oodles of questions, you can
bring them all
and get them answered.
Yeah, that's right.
Because otherwise you're going to hear us talk.
Nobody likes that.
Steve Ackerman and John Martin are weather guides from the University of Wisconsin-Madison, our guests. Thanks to them. Thank you for listening. Stay with us. Lots in store on the Ideas Network.
Hi, this is Ed, as you host Ben Marins. I hope you'll join me today starting at 3. We'll discuss how to have a deep conversation in today's text me, tweet me world and how to make the time for it. After 4, we'll look at a top news story of the day, why it matters and why it matters to you. That's all at issue later today, beginning at 3 here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.
Support for WPR comes from Overture Center, presenting Ballet Folklorico de Mexico, Tuesday, October 9th, featuring dancing traditions of Mexico, from pre-Columbian civilizations to today's growing Hispanic influences. Tickets at